Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 and another one of our RVs. I'm not even going to ask Tim what that means.
It's RV 7.
We've done 7 of these.
This is the 7th RV.
And I will ask you what it means.
So an RV is a rendezvous. It's a location of consolidation. And in our version of the RV, we reflect on previous episodes and also take questions from listeners.
So let's do just that, Tim. Our last, one of our recent episodes of Principles of War as They Apply to Business. Follow-ups on that.
You've got me out of order.
So let's do just that, Tim. We are coming off the back of our pretty insightful discussion with Matt Hall, famous Red Bull air racer, former F/A-18 pilot. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, just how meticulous he is in terms of his preparation, getting not just the machine right, but everything associated with competition, and importantly, his need to be well physically prepared and psychologically prepared. Just the meticulous nature of how he prepares, both for a race, but in everything he does leading up to a race. And a really good example, in fact, only in the last few days, he's had profound engine troubles ahead of a European race. And I read a quote from him this morning. He said, and I quote, "The one thing we're good at is contingencies. We've got plan A, B, C, and D ready to go."
I like it. And there's that fine balance between having those contingencies for the foreseen plans, but still being having that flexibility of mind to adapt regardless of what life throws at you. And I imagine, you know, you spoke about the very meticulous nature of what he does. There's a pretty high incentive in the system in which he operates to be meticulous. There's not a lot of room for error when you're, you know, 10 feet off the ground doing 450 kilometers an hour and pulling 12 G's. It really shows that to succeed in that, you need to have not only all of those preparations done, all of those contingencies squared away, but be able to have that rapidity of thought and the flexibility to adapt to whatever the machine, the environment, the system throws at you.
You asked him a question on how beneficial or otherwise pre-existing flying training is going into pilot's course and in particular fighter course. And he said that ingrained habit patterns can often be detrimental. I was reflecting on whether ingrained habit patterns, that is good habit patterns, can be beneficial. If you can establish good routine, good process in your life, that habit patterns can benefit you.
Without a doubt. And, you know, you get these spidey senses that we've spoken about before, and we'll talk about this, I think, a bit later on in this very episode, but these intuition, we've spoken about Anders Ericsson and his 10,000 hours, where you get this almost prescient nature with something you're expert in. These are fantastic. These give us these heuristics that allow us to get ahead of that decision cycle. But as with everything in life, there's a trade-off. We need to be able to balance that against falling into these, what Dietrich Dorner would call methodism. So just unthinkingly reapplying stuff that's worked in the past. So it's always that fine balance between those really good habit patterns and the grooves, you know, the myelination paths in your brain, but not being still able to remain open to changed circumstances that would dictate a requirement for a different set of behaviours.
And Matt Hall has to win this year, Ben, because sadly overnight Red Bull have announced that the Red Bull Air Race, this will be the last season. So we do hope Matt brings home the victory.
The gold. Is it gold? What do you get?
Trophy? Can of Red Bull?
Carton of Red Bull.
They're very generous nowadays.
Yep.
All right, so then reflections on principles of war.
Yeah.
Now, some interesting feedback we've had, contrasting the principles of war that we've drawn from Australian Army doctrine into the business environment, which we describe as the second battlefield. It is brutal and unforgiving out there on the business battlefield.
It is. It definitely is. And I think we came back saying that apart from a significantly reduced requirement for gunship support, there are a lot of correlations between principles of war in the military context and how we might apply them in the business sense.
And we had some great feedback today on a couple of the principles, maintenance of morale, the importance of coordination, and this is all from an elite team. That was all quite interesting, and the fact that they needed to knit some of that better together.
Yeah, and looking back on that episode, I think I used the word complementarity. But yeah, the idea of being able to use a whole bunch of people within your team, their strengths and weaknesses, A, knowing them, and B, being able to apply them in a sense that gives you that strongest performance.
We are bad at podcasting and we are linguistically weak. A bit like your deadlift. We also had a question on Richard Thaler, the economist who we very much like, who pioneered what we called SIFs in the last episode on the principles of war, what Thaler calls supposedly irrelevant factors, and people wanted some amplification on Thaler and also the SIF. So Thaler was a pioneer in behavioral economics with two psychologists, including Danny Kahneman, and you might talk about Kahneman in a little while. And they collaborated to develop this field called behavioral economics. Now, Thaler will say that behavioral economics has been around since Adam Smith and maybe even before, but people just never quite defined it and gave it a title. So the interesting thing about Thaler is that to mainstream economists, this behavioral economics was just an irritant. They saw him as a complete outlier. His descriptions were inelegant, to say the least. Because he was factoring in how real humans think, it just didn't quite fit with the macroeconomics or even microeconomics. He wrote a book called Nudge, which I've read. And Nudge is all about making sure that you are just pushing things in the right direction for success. He uses this interesting analogy of a fruit bowl in a cafeteria. He says if you've got a fruit bowl, in a prime place in a cafeteria, people are more likely to go for a piece of fruit than they are a junk food. And all around the world, people are now running these nudge units, which is harnessing the power of Thaler's idea. We've previously talked about things that are relevant to nudging. We've talked about this application in our own lives of not just the fruit bowl, but placing your alarm out of reach, nudges you to get out of bed, you know, having your gym gear on the ground. So all of those things are giving you some level of guidance to get up and going in the morning. And Nick Caldwell talked about the discipline to get out of bed. So on to SIFs, the supposedly irrelevant factors. And what Thaler says is that how people actually live their lives is not irrelevant at all. He uses this really interesting contrast on sunk costs, which most economists would say are ignored. Once you've paid for your year of office lease, you just don't worry about that. And even if you hate the facility 3 months later, there's not much you can do about it. So Thaler says in a context of a restaurant, so suppose you go to a really expensive restaurant and you have a fantastic meal, they bring out the dessert menu and you order your favorite dessert. But after the first bite, you realize you're actually really full. So you don't need this. You don't need it nutritionally. And you certainly don't need it in terms of your waistline. What would most people do? Most people would continue to eat, even though that dessert is also a sunk cost. So the supposedly irrelevant factors using that particular metaphor is quite interesting, Ben.
Yeah. I love Thaler's approach because it addresses the elephant in the room, and that is that life is messy. I'm a big fan of complexity theory because it talks about the fact that there aren't these linear relationships between cause and effect, and that these tiny little butterfly effect type inputs, weak signals, SIFs, whatever we call them, can actually end up having a massive output in life. And we trick ourselves as humans by using these simplified models. Economists use supply and demand curves, which are beautifully, linear representations.
Which Thaler would say are completely imprecise.
100%. And there's a fantastic Freakonomics podcast episode which talks about the fact that they don't actually exist in real life. They posit that Uber pricing is about as close as we get to a real life supply and demand curve. But again, it doesn't follow the theory perfectly because there are weird, funky human things in there, like the fact that if it's raining or if it's super hot or if there's a, you know, sporting event on or any of these different things, they can have a disproportionate effect on what you would predict as levels of demand. And so I think Thaler is completely in line with these complexity ideas that, you know, it is messy. We should let go of the precise idea. And in fact, by making these neat models, we actually take out a lot of the really important stuff. We simplify it. So we end up trying to address essentially a kindergarten version of the real world problem. And this is why things like a wicked problems discussion we've had before, it's really important to get your head around these things. It's messy, it's imprecise. Often there's no actual answer, there's no real solution, but we still need to be able to exist and lead and succeed in this kind of environment.
Yeah, the failurism on that supply and demand is that, you know, is a recognition by most economists that when the price goes up, demand goes down. Thaler asks the question, well, by how much? And the general answer is less. Can we talk running shoes and motor cars, which is another Richard Thaler?
Yeah, I think we might have even used this example. It's a fantastic one. But yeah, the idea being that if your favorite pair of running shoes normally retails at $200, it was half price for $100 on the other side of town, you'd probably jump in the car and race across to get them. And yet if you were buying a new car and it was $30,000 in one shop and $29,900 on the other side of town, you probably wouldn't bother making the trip. And the rationale is, you know, that makes no sense. It's exactly the same distance, exactly the same
effort,
exactly the same reward.
Yeah.
And yet the mental arithmetic that goes behind it skews you in one direction.
So Danny Kahneman, who is a good friend of Thaler's, says two things about Thaler, Ben. The first is he's a genius. And the second is that he's lazy. And he's famous for being lazy. And that laziness has been a big part of his success, which Thaler concedes, yes, I am lazy. And Thaler contextualizes this by saying, my laziness means that I have little patience to work on the things that I'm not interested in that aren't important to me.
And as we've discussed before, I think Thaler would have been a general under von Moltke, who reckons that the smart, lazy people are the ones you want to promote into these leadership positions because they're clever enough to work out what right looks like. But they're also too lazy to do the grind. They'll come up with an elegant way of working out what's the actual important stuff and what's the quickest and most efficient way of achieving it.
Now, Ben, challenging questions. We always get them. We've got a good one today.
Cracker.
Hopefully I'll stump you. It's from Kieran in the UK. He's an engineer by qualification in a leadership role for a major oil and gas company. That is, he has been temporarily in a leadership role. And the question is, I've recently filled in as a team leader for the last 4 months while awaiting my boss's role to be filled. In that time, I've received a lot of praise from other teams and other bosses. Now my new leader has joined. How can I best help or support them to transition into the role without getting in their way? No one wants someone in their team telling them, this is how I did it constantly. What should Kieran do?
There's a big element of allowing the new leader to imprint their own personality. And I think, Kieran, the fine balance that you'll need to walk is supporting them in terms of providing that familiarity with the context. So there will be an element of this is how we've done it. This is what I've experienced in terms of success in the past. And this is where, you know, I might have stuffed up in the past. But also allowing that new leader to imprint his or her own personality on the role. And so that may accept doing things in a slightly different way. The big thing from my perspective would be a lot of those conversations obviously will be behind closed doors. And the thing that I reckon will be critical, and it's difficult and it's areas that I've let myself down in the past, is in your interaction with people within your team. There are probably going to be people who will offer that, you know, you were a better leader, or maybe, you know, there might be some growing pains as the new leader steps in. It is super seductive to sort of participate in that water cooler conversation, and or even not dampen it and allow your ego to be sort of puffed up by these things. Like I said, I've done that in the past, and I've felt pretty pretty bad as a result of it in the end. I think as much as your interactions with the new leader are important, I think your interactions with the existing team are going to be really important in terms of supporting the new leader establishing themselves in their role.
I don't think I've ever taken over an organization where I haven't wanted my predecessor to leave as quickly as possible. But the one thing that you definitely need them for is to demystify the human environment, because that's not something that can be rapidly learned or you can get rapidly orientated on. So all of those nuances on staffing, staff that you know well and have led, the things that are important to them, what motivates and drives, the challenges that you've put in front of them, that's a really useful base plate for the guy coming into the new role, and certainly one that you can assist him on. I would say that you're obligated to make sure that they're set up for success. And if nothing else, outside of demystifying that human environment, the complexity of humans, you just simply need to let them know that you're in and around and available if indeed they want a little bit of background information, which is really all it is, background information.
It's a fantastic point that Tim makes, one of the rare fantastic points that Tim has made. But no one wants to take over from a popular and successful boss. You want to take over from someone who was terrible, because then you automatically shine by comparison. I reckon, Kieran, you know, you need to recognize that the new boss is probably got big shoes to fill, and help them out in that respect. Now, Tim, we've been doing a bit of traveling recently.
We have been doing a little bit of traveling in different directions, which has been fantastic.
Yeah.
Not having to deal with you in the same time zone, in the same room, in the same studio.
You still managed to annoy me across the world.
Talking about human complexity.
Very much. I spent a week in DC.
How was it? What were you there for?
I was there for a board meeting, and I think DC is a fantastic city. Both inside and outside of uniform, I've had the absolute privilege of spending a bit of time in Washington, D.C., and it always strikes me as, you know, the gravitas of that city is pretty unmistakable. The monuments, the nature of the buildings, you know, you can really feel that it's the centre of something. It's interesting times in that great city at the moment with the current administration, a lot of interesting reflections on how it's being run and different points of view on whether that's a good or bad thing for the institution of the President of the United States. But nevertheless, such an amazing city, full of history and obviously still extremely relevant contemporary.
And inside your board meeting, some big IQs, smart people. You had some interesting people talking to you. How do you deal with those big IQs?
Well, I think I reflected to you, Tim, that, and particularly working with you, it's rare for me to feel like the dumbest person in the room.
Which is probably why you work with me.
Maybe. But I was certainly that in a lot of the rooms I was in over that week. But that's good. I think that dose of humility, the exposure to concepts that are new and you're still sort of developing understanding and opinions on, it's pretty good to get that challenge, that continued learning throughout your life.
I've got a US Shark Tank pitch for you. Are you ready?
Yep, hit me.
In fact, I have stolen this a little bit to paraphrase a guy called Michael Roberto, who's a business professor, used to be in Harvard, now I think at a place called Bryant. My Shark Tank pitch, you've got a pocket full of money.
Yep.
I want to open a new kind of grocery store. We're going to do it in the US, but we're not going to have any branded items. We're only going to have 10% of items on what typically you'd see in a grocery store, and it's all going to be privately labeled. No television advertising, no social media. We're never going to have anything on sale. We're not going to accept the coupons that usually you see accepted in the US. No loyalty card. And we won't do anything inside key publications. certainly no self-checkout, and we're not going to have wide aisles. We're not going to have big parking lots. And in fact, at some of our stores, we're not going to have any parking at all. You want to invest?
Tim, you will not get a red cent from me for that idea.
So that's Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Which is actually one of my favourite places to go in Washington, D.C., D.C. being one of my favourite cities. And there's a great deal of purity and delight walking into a Trader Joe's shop.
Yeah, no, and it's an institution in a lot of cities in the States, but certainly I'll use Harry Moffat's term, the glitterati of D.C. would not be caught dead shopping anywhere else. So it does go to show that on paper, something that looks like a terrible business idea can still get a bit of traction.
Yeah, they're at the top of the supermarket chains in the US by a wide margin. Their sales per square foot estimates are significantly more than the competitors, 2 to 3 times better, apparently. And per square foot, they outsell every other grocery store, but they breed this institutional loyalty. I was reading about these Facebook pages that get created that people are driven to record their interest in a Trader Joe's being open up into their little pocket in their little pocket of the US. And interestingly, it was Germans. The Aldi chain bought Trader Joe's in the US, a very secretive Trader Joe's in the US.
I did not know that.
So for those Australian listeners, it's the Albrecht family who own Aldi in Australia, obviously born from Aldi in Germany, that also own Trader Joe's.
And so while I was gallivanting around Washington, D.C., you, Tim, were in the artist formerly known as Saigon.
That's
right. Ho Chi Minh City.
Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, doing some work for a oil and gas company.
Your first time there?
My first time in Ho Chi Minh City, so very exciting. I love going to new places. I explore them always on foot. I tend to get out of the hotel and just walk, have a broad plan. And one of the things that I absolutely had to do, I was a little time poor in Ho Chi Minh City with work, but I absolutely wanted to go to the War Remnants Museum.
And you did?
And you've been to Ho Chi Minh City.
I have.
Have you done the War Remnants Museum?
Yes. This is, I was going to say decades, at least 10 or 11 years ago.
Mm. It's funny, I walked in thinking, I'll get some great snaps, you know, I'll send a couple of things across to family and friends just to, you know, talk a little bit about the War Remnants Museum, and maybe peculiarly I'll post something on social media. I think I took about 4 steps into the War Remnants Museum and it was so powerful that I just couldn't do it. I didn't feel right sending anything. You know, there's some incredible stuff in that, and for anyone that is going anywhere near Ho Chi Minh City, or even if you're planning a holiday, incredible place, you must go to the War Remnants Museum. A whole room on the use of chemical defoliants by the US and Australians and others during the Vietnam War, and the generational damage that those defoliants have done. Large section on torture and abuse. And it's funny, I walked out of there feeling like I've got better balance. I'd got the story from the Vietnamese side, and we've only read history from one side before that. And Andrew Hastie talks about Ben Sasse, the Nebraskan senator, who says, read the other side's newspaper. And I think metaphorically I did that. It was actually quite uplifting.
Yeah. I've often, and particularly the older and I guess somewhat wiser I get, a heuristic for me, if I've got a black and white, if I've got a very firm opinion on something, that's a warning sign that I don't know enough about it. There is always another side, even on what I think, you know, would commonly be thought of as very cut and dried opinions. There's always another perspective. There's always another angle. And especially now with, you know, echo chambers in social media, algorithms telling us stuff we already believe in terms of news feeds, it's so important to proactively seek out that alternate point of view to make yourself, you know, a more balanced in terms of your worldview.
The museum tells the story of John McCain, the US politician. And what I didn't realize is that they saved him. He would have drowned. He parachuted out of his aircraft into a lake. He was badly injured, and there was a lot of effort and a lot of risk just to save him from the lake.
Super interesting.
I think that's it. Thanks very much for listening to the RV, and we'll see you next time.
Catch up
on the Unforgiving 60.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen, politicians, get around.